Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today. I just talked with Matt Crawford about his new book that came out with the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2016, The Andean Wonder Drug, Cinchona Bark and Imperial Science in the Spanish Atlantic, 1630 to 1800. So this is a book about a really fascinating case study in the context of early modern and 18th century science in the Spanish Atlantic world that opens up from a particular example, right? This is the example of quina or cascarilla. You may be more familiar with the term quinine, right? Or cinchona, cinchona bark. And it opens out from that very particular case study into much broader questions about the relationship between science and empire, the place of and the significance of indigenous healing and practices and knowledge to how we understand the production of science in the early modern worlds, and all kinds of related issues. The nature of the epistemic culture of Spanish colonial science, all kinds of really interesting things are going on in this book. So throughout the book and throughout the conversation, implicitly or explicitly, Matt invokes the significance of particular archives and collections of documents in shaping the story. So you'll hear him talk early on about the significance of discovering, and this was in 2004, bundles of manuscripts labeled documents related to the discovery and development of quinine when he was in Spain. He also talks frequently in the book about the significance of particular kinds of historical, archival, and documentary records for understanding aspects of this story. And one of the really interesting things about the book, and you'll hear us talking about this in a few moments, is the way that Matt brings together different kinds of evidence, different kinds of documents, including ethnobotanical work, including kind of contemporary or modern scientific and biomedical work on the nature of particular diseases, in order to tell this very multifaceted story. So the book is separated into two parts. Part one looks at what it meant to know nature, right, in quotes, in the early modern Atlantic world, and it traces the transformation of quina from a local Andean remedy into a botanical commodity and then an imperial natural resource in the Spanish Atlantic world from the mid-17th to the mid-18th centuries. Now, this shows here in this part of the book that the transformations were the results of the bark's integration into a whole bunch of networks of circulation of people, of texts, of objects, and of images. And these networks were Andean networks, Atlantic networks, and imperial networks. Part two of the book turns us from that to the context of conflicts in the late 18th century as the Spanish crown tried to assert greater control over the tree and its bark. And you'll hear about how that worked out for them over the course of the conversation. So with that, I will let you get to it and just say this is a really fascinating study for anyone interested in the history of the early modern world, the history of materia medica, the history of drugs, history of natural history. So there's a lot going on that's of interest to, I think, a broad number of kinds of communities of readers here. Thank you so much for listening and for your support of the channel, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Matthew James Crawford about his new book, The Andean Wonder Drug. Welcome to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast, Matt. Thanks so much for writing a fascinating book and also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Of course. So let's start at the beginning. How did you come to work in the field of history of science? Why early modern science or 18th century, right, in particular, and why science in the Spanish Atlantic world?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a complicated story, as I imagine is for most people. I didn't know about the history of science until late in my undergraduate career. I was actually a biology major for a long time, and then just got interested in history and started taking history courses. And I met a faculty member that I wanted to do a senior thesis project with, and sat down with him and had some ideas. And he said to me, well, how is your interest in science going to work into this? And I said, well, it isn't, because this is a history project, you know.
Yeah.
And that was then when he informed me about this field, history of science. And I didn't actually get a chance to take any courses in history of science as an undergraduate, but wrote a senior thesis on monsters in the early modern world. And I guess that's part of how I got into the early modern, was the faculty member I was working with, Howard Solomon, who's now retired from Tufts University. He was an early modernist, and I had taken courses with him and just discovered the strange and interesting world of the early modern. And, really enjoyed him as a teacher, but also the material and the readings in the early modern. And so that's kind of how I ended up in early modern. And then through working on this senior thesis, got interested in the idea of, you know, sort of how does modern science come about? You know, how do we go from a world, you know, kind of the classic question of how do we go from a world of magic and, you know, seemingly strange beliefs from our perspective to the kind of science that we have today. It was sort of by accident, I guess, in a way. And then I decided that's what I wanted to follow up with in graduate school, doing graduate degrees in, because I enjoyed doing that senior thesis. So,
and you know, the early modern or the world of early modern science is really, objectively speaking, the best part of the field. So,
yes, I would agree with that.
Listeners know, if anyone's like, you know, I think I want to study the history of science, what period
right.
should I focus on?
Right.
Just so that they know, objectively, the early modern period.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yes.
So what I'll do is I'll say a little bit about the book to kind of situate listeners who may not have had a chance to see it or to read it yet. And then I'll ask you kind of what brought you to this particular topic. And if any of what I'm about to say sounds articulate, it is not my fault. It's not my doing. It's the doing of the book, because some of this is relating the words of the book. And so if any of this sounds good, it's due to Matt, listeners, and not due to me. So the book focuses on a medicinal tree bark that I'm going to mispronounce. Matt, tell me if I'm getting this right. Kina?
Right? Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Kina or cascaria? Is that right?
That is correct also,
Yay.
Yes.
Okay, so the book focuses on this medicinal tree bark. It looks very closely at the struggles of the Spanish Empire in the second half of the 18th century to control this tree and its bark, right? And this cinchona, is that right?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Cinchona. Yep. You know, I write about cinchona, and because I never talk about it, I actually didn't know how to pronounce it. I was cinchona?
Some people say cinchona. Because
I was wondering.
Yeah, but in Spanish, I've always heard it cinchona. So
we're gonna call it cinchona then.
Yeah.
We're going to call it cinchona. Okay, so it looks at the struggles of this empire in the second half of the 18th century to control the cinchona tree and its bark, and it also traces the history of quina as a product of local, imperial, and commercial networks in the 18th century Atlantic world. Now, the book shows, among other things, that science proved to be a relatively ineffective kind of thing in Spanish imperial enterprise when compared, at least, to other European empires in the contemporary 18th century world. Now, the case study for understanding this, and we'll talk about this in the context of the chapters specifically, is the Royal Reserve of Quina's attempts to produce a kind of synergy of science and empire, as you describe it here, to try to improve royal reserves of the substance, and also to strengthen imperial control over the trees and their bark. And as we get into the conversation, we'll hear about sort of why the empire would have been interested in this, right? Why the crown would have been interested in this substance in particular, and then how they managed these efforts to control the tree and the bark. Now, the book argues that this relative inefficacy of science here was for two main reasons, and I'll just name these and then we'll kind of open out. The first reason is that the context mattered. The Andean and Atlantic contexts mattered. This was a very particular kind of geography of knowledge, as the book shows. And in the words of the book, in this particular context, Andean forests and Atlantic ports were as much centers of knowledge production as European pharmacies and botanical gardens. Now, this was due in part, as you show here in the words of the book, to the tenacity of bark collectors, of merchants, and of local officials in asserting the authority of their own knowledge and expertise, and we'll talk about that. This was also due to the structure and style of Spanish colonial governance, which, as you show here in the words of the book, undermined the authority and efficacy of European science, especially since science and empire were so profoundly intertwined in the Spanish Atlantic world. Whew, okay, so there's a lot of really fascinating things going on there, and there are so many wonderful stories and details that we'll talk about that flesh out all of that. But before we get there, Matt, how did you come to Kena? Like, why Kena as your case study, and why this particular way of understanding Kena in the book?
Right, okay, so, you know, it was a bit by design and it was a bit by serendipity. So when I was in graduate school and thinking about projects that I was interested in, I was thinking about the relationship between science and the state, that sort of general theme, and particularly interested in the ways that sort of states make knowledge about the natural world. At some point I had read James Scott's Seeing Like a State, and that was sort of one of many influential books that I read, but just got me thinking about the way that states produce knowledge. And at that point I was already thinking about a kind of Spanish colonial topic, Atlantic world topic, and so got interested in the Spanish Empire as a site of knowledge production. And, you know, at the point I was in graduate school, Jorge Canizares's Guerra's book had come out, and Antonio Barrera's work was sort of making its way through the pipeline, as well as Daniela Bleichmar and so forth. So there was this real wave of work in English on the Spanish Atlantic world and thinking precisely about these themes of science and empire. Now, the specific story of Kena, that's the sort of accidental side of the story. I had gone to the Archivo General de Indias, the main colonial archive in Seville, on a pre-dissertation research trip with a completely different project in mind, a 16th century project, which then sort of blew up in my face a little bit when I actually got to the archive. Not because it was non-existent, but just from talking to local scholars that knew the archive, they told me that the project that I had in mind was a very, very long-term project. You know, it would take a long time to kind of pull all the documents out of the archive. And so on my last, literally my last day of that trip, I decided to call out some documents that were called something like documents relating to the discovery and development of quinine. I mean, before that, I had really not even thought that much about quinine, you know, and didn't even realize that it existed as a live topic. But I called these documents out, and I, like I said, I literally had one day, but because quinine is of great interest in the history of medicine, in the 1930s, on the 300th anniversary of you know, the European, let's say, encounter with Cinchona bark, they had taken all the documents and kind of pulled them together into these nice bundles. And so I was looking through this bundle of, you know, the one I was looking at probably had about 1,500 documents in it. And just quickly looking through it, I don't know, intuition or something told me that there was a good project here about, you know, science and the state, and clearly there was all this knowledge that the Spanish state was collecting and circulating and even producing about this tree bark. And, you know, I went to some internet cafe and tried to look up as best as I could, you know, what had been written about it, and found that there hadn't been that much written about the Spanish side of the story. And so, you know, I took a bit of a gamble because I only had one day to look at these documents, but, you know, it turned out to be a very fruitful project. And then, you know, I went back to Spain the following year and then, you know, did various research trips and so forth. But you know, again, looking at these documents, I could really see that this theme that I was thinking about, the kind of interface between science and empire or science and the state, was really present in these documents. And, you know, it just felt like it would be a good story to tell and a good case study to explore.
Excellent. And in the transition from the dissertation instantiation of the project and the book we're talking about, were there any major transformations in how you were either kind of thinking about or structuring the project, or really just any major changes?
Yeah. So I would say structurally, if you look at the book itself, the first half of the book, that is the first three chapters, are really substantial new material and sort of a rethinking of the project to situate it more fully in the different contexts that you mentioned in your little intro of sort of the local Andean world, the Atlantic world, and then the larger sort of imperial context. I would say by and large, the dissertation was focused more narrowly on just the story of the Royal Reserve. And I think the dissertation was just my attempt to kind of, you know, because I had something like 15,000 pages related to the Royal Reserve, you know. So I think the dissertation was just my attempt to kind of put that information into some kind of order, right? And so that was sort of the first step. And then turning it into a book, in addition to thinking about, you know, the audience beyond my dissertation committee, you know, I really started to think more seriously about the context, the different contexts in which the story was happening. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the stuff about the Andean world and the Atlantic world, I mean, those were things that I was aware of when I wrote the dissertation. But when I was thinking about transforming into a book, I really, you know, I had the realization that I hadn't taken them seriously enough. And I needed to really, I need to really do more work to get that material in there. And part of that was having a fellowship at the John Carter Brown Library, which is, you know, this great library for the early history of the Americas, and just being in that environment that encouraged me to think about my project in a different way. That was really helpful. And then I would say the other major thing was just getting clearer on what was the main overarching argument that I wanted to make about science and empire and the contribution of the Spanish Atlantic world to hopefully the larger historiography of science and so forth. That was a real challenge, rewriting the introduction to make that clear, because there are so many different ways, so many different themes that I could reach out to with this project. And I was worried about it getting too diffuse and trying to do too much. And so I tried to really sit down and think, like, what's the biggest question that I want to engage that will hopefully engage the broadest possible number of readers? I don't know if I did that, but that was a major concern as well in revising from dissertation to book.
Well, let's actually get into it, and let's start with one of the chapters that you were just talking about. This is chapter one, which looks at Kena as a medicament. You show us here the local context of Kena in the Andean world. The bark was first associated with an Andean province of Loja, right? And this was a region, and you talk about this here, with a very long history as a center of medical knowledge and practice. And we learn a lot about this region for the purposes of the book here in this chapter. I think it's a really kind of wonderful contextualization. Now, one of the really interesting things happening in this chapter is you talk about the significance of indigenous healers and the sophistication of their practices to the story. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about that. For you, what's important for us to understand here in this part of the book about the significance of these healers, right? I mean, what was, and also what kind of documents, what kind of materials as a historian gave you access to understanding their practices and its significance, right? I mean, that's another really important part of this story.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, if, you know, the question of what's important, I'll start with that first. I mean, I think, you know, anybody who works on a project like this, and you're trying to, you know, write for a broader audience. I mean, certainly a lot of work has been done to kind of, diffuse or undermine or show how wrong the stereotypes about Indigenous people are or Indigenous groups are and their history and so forth. And what I really felt was important in this chapter was making sure that the readers or that I try to help the readers take Indigenous healers seriously as you know, for lack of a better term, quote unquote, experts, you know, people that come from a tradition of knowledge, you know, engage in this knowledge that are not, you know, their knowledge isn't static, it's dynamic. And, you know, that's of course one of the challenges because it's changing in response and in contact with, European knowledge that's coming over. Yeah, you know, and I mean, the fact is the sources don't really tell us, at least the sources that I know of, don't really tell us when Indigenous healers started using the bark. And there have been all kinds of arguments in the last 100, 150 years about whether they know or didn't know and so forth. And, you know, I mean, obviously I feel convinced that they had this knowledge. And so I wanted to make clear that, you know, not just that they had this knowledge, but it kind of made sense from what we think we know about their worldview and their healing practices and you know, sort of the medical cosmology of Andean healers and so forth. In terms of documents, obviously it's very difficult to get at this material and you know, I have to say I relied very heavily on the work of ethnobotanists, in particular an ethnobotanist at the Missouri Botanical Garden named Reiner Bussmann, who's done a lot of great studies actually in the Loja region of contemporary Indigenous healers. And of course, you know, you have to use that information with a certain amount of care and caution because you can't assume that what Indigenous healers are doing today is, you know, analogous or indicative of what they were doing in the 17th century or even before that. But, you know, it's one of the sources of information that we have, you know. So I relied on his work and some other anthropologists and also historians or historical anthropologists that have looked at different healing groups of healers in the Andean world, not all from Loja, but from some other parts of the Andean world. And then there are some places in the colonial archive where you can see a little bit about what Indigenous healers are doing. So that chapter starts off, you know, with the story of a guy who I think was likely an Indigenous healer that meets this. You know, there seems evidence that he's practicing a medicine in addition to harvesting the bark for the purposes of, you know, selling it in the local markets and so forth.
Thank you so much. And so some of what you were just talking about really nicely leads us into the second chapter. But I just want to mark for listeners that one of the really important points, at least for me as a reader that was made in this chapter before we move on is that it's really important as historians, and you can hear the sirens maybe in the background emphasizing the importance of this, right? Reminding me, talk about this in the context of what science is, Carla. Yes, yeah. Thank you, sirens, I will. So it's important to think broadly, right, as a historian about what counts as part of the history of science to right. include the kinds of practices and phenomena that are happening here, right? Did right. you want to speak to that a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I can't, in spite of the fact that I just published this book and, you know, I feel like the book represents my state of thinking at the time, it's a really difficult, I think, you know, for folks that work on science in colonial context or maybe science in general, I mean, it's a difficult, you know, it's a difficult problem, especially when you get down to the brass tacks of actually trying to construct a narrative, right? Because you want to make a distinction, or there may be some cases in which it's worth making a distinction between science, quote unquote, that's happening in early modern Europe that takes a particular form institutionally, socially, intellectually, and you know, and then what is variously called indigenous knowledge or vernacular knowledge or ethnomedicine, right? I mean, we have all these terms that kind of replicate this divide between European science, you know, with a capital S, and then non-European knowledges, right? And like I said, there are some cases where you want to make that distinction, but there are other instances where that's incredibly problematic because it's precisely that distinction that has meant that, you know, certain knowledges about the natural world, let's say, were left out of the story of the history of science because they were deemed as non-scientific or non-science. And I I think this is just a tension. I don't know that there's a really good answer to it. But in writing the book, I found it hard to find a language that would kind of allow me to talk about what, say, a European botanist and an indigenous healer and maybe a merchant who's doing some empirical testing, you know, talk about those in the same kind of sentence, if you will, you know what I mean, in the same context.
And this kind of thing, I think, is increasingly a concern of many historians right now, right? Not just yeah. historians of science, but as we kind of try to think expansively and practice expansively,
right.
in terms of, you know, the relationship of knowledge and power and who we're empowering. Well, actually, you know, it's not our job or our place, right, or our ability to empower anyone, but sort of
right.
at least reconceiving our practice and the boundaries of what constitute the field and the discipline to be more capacious, right, and open, I think, than in some
right.
ways they have been. I think this is a contribution to that that I really appreciated.
Thanks.
So part of what you mentioned before, I think really leads us nicely into the next chapter. You were talking about the significance of kind of, if we can call it braiding together, like ethnobotanical accounts with mm-hmm. other kinds of documentary evidence to try to tell this story. And I think that's a really great example of the way that the book not only in the content that it describes, right, but also in mm-hmm. its methodology, brings together very different forms of knowledge in telling this story. So you just talked
yeah.
about ethnobotany. We see this also in the next chapter, where you're looking
yeah.
at Kena as a commodity, and part of what's happening is here weaving together or bringing together not just archival records of imports to understand Kena as a commodity, but also looking at kind of epidemiological and scientific knowledge of mm-hmm. malaria, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a way of understanding how the importance of malaria in the early modern world, especially in its connection with the expansion of plantation agriculture in the Caribbean and the intensification of the Atlantic slave trade, but also just sort of how we understand the disease helps us understand this part of the story. So by...
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, did you want to talk a little bit about that?
No. I was just agreeing, yeah.
Yeah, and so this is a really striking part of this part of the book. So by the mid-18th century, here's where we are for listeners, the Spanish crown formally declared its interest in the bark as an imperial natural resource. And this chapter shows, and this is in the words of the book, how epidemiological, environmental, and economic developments in the wider Atlantic world are catalyzing the transformation of the bark from a local remedy into a global botanical commodity. Now, part of what's going on here is that to meet the demand, the scale of production of quina had to increase. What were some of the most, for you, significant consequences of that increase in scale and of this transformation into a commodity?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I think part of what this chapter is trying to do is talk about how cinchona bark became an object of interest, right? Because, you know, it didn't always work all the time. And, you know, I mean, there were certainly physicians and pharmacists in Europe that thought it was dangerous to use it because there were high profile cases where people died and so forth. And so, you know, really thinking about the different factors that came together to make this, you know, quina at this particular moment an object of interest to the Spanish Empire. So that's, you know, that's part of what this chapter is doing and why it's looking at all these different types of factors, as you mentioned, the epidemiological and environmental and so forth. And, you know, I mean, I think the question of the sort of significance of it, of the trade ramping up and so forth, I mean, there's many different ways that you could look at that, right? One that I'll just mention in particular is, again, if you look at the local Andean context, it's kind of one of these cases of, you know, interesting sort of historical coincidence of a sort, because, you know, the local economy starts to decline for various reasons. You know, there were some gold mines in the area and their production starting to drop off, but also the textile industry is sort of moving away. And, you know, so in a way it was very fortuitous for the people in this region that, you know, this local medicament that they produced was all of a sudden becoming a global commodity, right? So it was incredibly important to them. And perhaps misspoke a little bit when I said it was a coincidence, because I do think that there are larger shifts in the Atlantic world that are, you know, sort of interconnected here and so forth. But yeah, it's an incredibly important on the local level. And then you can go to the other end of the scale, and the fact that this bark was becoming more readily available. You do have, in spite of the questions about its efficacy, you know, you do have now more readily available a truly efficacious treatment in most cases for malaria, which is a very, very old human disease and had plagued human populations for millennia and was a major problem in certain parts of the Atlantic world, as various scholarship has shown. So that's certainly a significant outcome as well. And then, you know, I mean, the other story that comes to mind is actually a story that I think Hal Cook talks about in one of his articles, of, you know, the Jesuits bringing the bark to the Emperor of China in the late 17th century. Maybe this is a story that you know as well, and sort of the way that they used that object to ingratiate themselves with, you know, the local powers that be. They did that in Europe as well. And so, you know, there are a number of different things that are going on, you know, on the two ends of the scale, from the local to the global level. And then, you know, the bark's just, it's more present. People are, you know, people are able to write about it and study it and so forth. And that has all kinds of interesting consequences.
Yeah, there's this really cool Manchu language text from the 18th century that's about medicinal drugs and diseases that they can be used to treat. And there's like a section that's pretty much all Cinchona all the time, which is actually really cool, right?
And that's interesting.
Well, we can talk about that also another time. We'll do that. But in the meantime, right, one of the things I really liked about this chapter, also before we move on, is that it pays careful attention to the importance of human labor and laborers to the production of kina. And so, again, it's just really sensitive to the physical and material and human consequences and sort of important contributions to this production of knowledge.
Could I just say one thing on that?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's another thing that I try to emphasize in the book. You know, I think somebody just kind of coming at this book, hearing about it for the first time and, you know, hearing, you know, discussion of a tree bark, you know, I mean, that seems like such a, you know, I mean, you could go outside right now and pick the bark off a tree, right? But one of the things I really try to make clear in the book, and this is connected to these laborers that are in the forests of Loja collecting the bark, is that the bark is, I mean, it's a product of the natural world, but it's also a product of human artifice as well, right? I mean, you have to have, in addition to whatever knowledge that you have as a, you may or may not have as a healer, because not all the laborers are necessarily healers, you have to have a technical skill to go out into the rainforest, find the trees. I mean, that's a skill in and of itself. And then know which bark to harvest, know how to dry it in the right way so that it's virtue, as they called it, and you know, prepare it for to be shipped across the ocean. You know, so yeah, there's a quite a bit of knowledge that goes into making kina before it even arrives at somebody's bedside table for them to ingest, you know.
Absolutely. And the next chapter, we won't have time to talk about this at much length, but I think it really nicely highlights precisely the significance of the transformations of kina as an object, right? The fact that it had multiple identities in the context of looking at it as a natural resource. And so in chapter three, just to sort of briefly tag this, and then we'll move to part two of the book, this chapter is looking at kina as a natural resource, and it shows precisely these multiple identities, right? It was an object of Andean medicine. It was an object of Atlantic commerce, imperial policy, and also European science and medicine. And this chapter really takes us into the networks that facilitated the circulation of the bark and very different kinds of, but articulating knowledges about it, indigenous knowledge, Atlantic, and imperial. This is also the chapter that takes us into the process by which the Royal Reserve of kina was established in Loja in 1751, and the ways that kina became an object of empire. For people who are particularly interested in historical epistemology, right, to use that phrase, or at least the history of forms of knowledge and epistemic cultures, another really interesting thing happening in this chapter is that it's showing and taking us into what it locates as a distinctive epistemic culture of the Spanish colonial government, right, as it made kina legible and also amenable to imperial administration. And you talk about the significance of hierarchy, of like firsthand experience and empiricism, and also the significance of local knowledge and expertise to that. So this is to say, we could talk for the next half hour just about that. It's a fascinating. But let's talk about what's happening later in the 18th century. And this brings us into the second part of the book. Chapter four takes us into a kind of relationship between people and administrative units. And this is something, looking at conversations and debates and relationships is something that I think all or most of the chapters in this second part of the book do. This chapter looks at the relationship between the Royal Pharmacy in Madrid, which received and examined a lot of the kina from South America, and the Royal Reserve in Loja, which had just been established in 1751, and this produced annual kina shipments for the crown. Now, the chapter looks at a disagreement between Madrid pharmacists and Loja bark collectors over which kind of kina was superior. Now, significantly, the bark collectors emerged as the winners. So, Matt, to take us into this chapter a little bit. Can you talk about this a little bit? Like, what was for you significant about the nature of this disagreement, and why is it so important for the story that the book is telling that the bark collectors are the ones who basically win the day?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think just to to kind of start with the bark collectors, you know, I think one of the goals of this book is to sort of push back against this idea of science and empire always sort of fitting together hand in glove and ruling with an iron fist, which is a vast simplification of a very important strand of scholarship. I think that even without that, I think, you know, coming at this from the 21st century, I mean, again, you know, most folks have a sense that science is pretty powerful, and the default assumption might be, oh, in these sorts of situations, of course, the botanists are going to win out because they have, I don't know, the most sophisticated explanation, or they're most closely connected to the crown. But what's interesting about this story is it's a case where that doesn't happen. So what I try to do in the chapter is kind of show the epistemic culture of the Spanish colonial bureaucracy in action, and the way that the knowledge of these bark collectors was taken seriously by many people in the bureaucracy. And it was just kind of fascinating to me that they can ultimately sort of prevail, even though, there's this institution in Madrid, the Royal Pharmacy, it's literally in the Royal Palace in Madrid. I mean, you know, it couldn't be any better connected to the center of power, if it wanted to be. They're effectively sort of defeated in this case, by the bark collectors who assert the authority of their knowledge and their firsthand experience and all that stuff. The other thing that's interesting about this story to me is you actually have this sample of bark that kind of goes back and forth across the Atlantic a couple of times, at least if you believe the sources. I just thought it was an interesting kind of case because, you know, most of our story about, say, the relationship between Latin America and Europe in the early modern period is that Latin America is just bleeding natural resources to Europe, which are then being used for, I mean, the classic case, of course, is silver. But even cinchona bark, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of pounds being shipped to Europe and other parts of the Atlantic world. And here's a case where a piece of bark, you know, sort of goes against that current. And then, you know, the bark collectors are able to kind of make this convincing case and kind of assert their authority within the epistemic culture of the empire. So that was interesting to me, you know, because there aren't, I don't know, many stories like that that I'm aware of. So.
Thank you, Matt. And for listeners who are interested in not just the nature of this disagreement and the consequences, but also how it played out further, Chapter 5 looks at one of the main consequences of that disagreement in detail and its resolution. And this is, as you show here and describe, the expansion of the community of experts in Spain who were charged mm-hmm. with testing and examining cinchona bark. And you talk about the ways that in the 1770s and 1780s, Madrid officials begin looking beyond the expertise of the Royal Pharmacy, and you take us into right the new kinds of methods of analysis that start to be used at the Royal Pharmacy. So it's actually quite an interesting expansion of this story. Mm-hmm. And this brings us to chapters 6 and 7, the last body chapters of mm-hmm. the book. Now, these are chapters that look very closely at the experience of botanists as agents of empire. Chapter 6 looks at the experience of Vicente. Is that Vicente?
Vicente, yeah.
Vicente, mm-hmm. The Italian-American in me wants to, like, pronounce all the C's as Ch, you know, Vicente, right? Like, mozzarella.
Right.
So, in 1789, the crown appoints Vicente Olmedo, this botanist chemist, as director mm-hmm. of the Royal Reserve in Loja. Now, in the words of the book, he soon discovered that the utility and authority of European science had limited efficacy in the face of the larger challenges of colonial society. Basically, science was not enough to guarantee effective imperial control. So, Matt, can you talk about that? I mean, you talk about some important aspects of what he faced in the chapter, including the difficulty of working with laborers, right, indigenous laborers, the sort of challenge of working with plantations. You talk about his interest in the production of quinoa extract. But for you, what's most interesting and significant about these challenges that he faced in terms of the larger work that the book is doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, again, you know, the part of, you know, part of what the chapter's trying to do is really situate Olmedo in the local challenges of working in Loja, because that's where he goes. That's where the Royal Reserve is. And as you said, I mean, the sending of him is, in my reading, a sort of extended response to that earlier victory of the bark collectors that we were talking about. Because in that earlier conflict, the crown had actually sent instructions from the Royal Pharmacy in Madrid to the bark collectors and said, you should use these. And the bark collectors say, yeah, we're not going to do that, right? So you can sort of read what happens with Olmedo in the context of that longer sort of decades dialogue. And, you know, the crown has finally said, all right, well, if they're not going to listen to our instructions, we're going to send somebody to make them happen. And yeah, I mean, Olmedo, in conjunction with the local colonial official, the corregidor, the sort of royal governor, find that, you know, things on the ground are actually quite challenging, you know, and it isn't just a matter of simple instructions and so forth. And so the book really tries to really show how, in this local context, the challenges that he faced, and as you mentioned, there are sort of a number of them. And one of the things he's tasked with doing is establishing plantations, right? And which would be a great idea because, you know, throughout the 18th century, the barks being harvested from trees, they're disappearing. I mean, there are multiple reports in the Spanish archives that, you know, they're having difficulty finding the trees and so forth. And so he wants to set up these plantations, and he does this kind of model plantation, but it never catches on. And part of that has to do with this is a, you know, it's a capital starved region, right? Nobody's gonna, take the time and perhaps the money to invest in setting up a plantation of a crop that has never been subjected to plantation agriculture before, right? They might, you know, just, you know, one hates to impute motives to historical actors, but, you know, sort of rationally, it might make more sense to go with the known crop, you know. So that's one of the challenges. And then there's still this kind of economic recession in the highlands of the Audiencia of Quito. And so the seasonal laborers that Olmedo is taking the time to train how to properly harvest and prepare the bark, they're sort of, you know, they're moving away. They're going to the coast in seek of better job opportunities. And so he complains about that. And then there's the technological issue. The crown wants him to start making this extract of the bark, which was becoming popular in Europe and maybe seemed like a better way to have the bark travel as an extract. And he just doesn't have the technology to do it, and he has a hard time getting the technology and so forth. And so, you know, there are all these sort of these factors that you know that are kind of sources of resistance to what he's expected to do as a representative of imperial science in this local context, right? So it was just it. his story, I thought, was an interesting kind of microcosm on the one hand of the relationship between science and empire, because that chapter also talks about his relationship with the local colonial official and how their duties are kind of broken up. But it's also an interesting story about the challenges that, of doing, you know, sort of quote unquote imperial science in a local context.
Mm-hmm. So this brings us to the final body chapter of the book. This is chapter 7. This chapter looks at a major debate among Spanish naturalists over the classification and the nature of quina. Now, this debate hinged on, as you show in this chapter, competing visions of the imperial order. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we have on the one hand, or in one corner of the ring, we have Mutis, right? Jose Celestino Mutis. He had been the director of Royal Botanical Expedition in New Granada, and he has a particular vision of empire that is regalist, and I'm going to ask you about this in a moment. On the other hand, at least one of the people who's involved in this debate is Hipólito Ruiz. He had been the former director of the Royal Botanical Expedition to Peru and Chile, one of them at least, and he espouses a kind of mercantile vision of empire. So you're showing in this debate, in part, the ways in which what we might consider to be scientific issue, right? A debate around particularly scientific or naturalist issues, right? Is how do you, what's the basis of classifying this object? Is it the bark? Is it the tree, right? Are ultimately grounded in sort of larger distinctions or visions about the nature of the empire and imperial order. And so this is really, really interesting. So let's start getting into it. Matt, what's the nature of the debate here? Can you kind of catch up listeners as to, you know, what are they arguing about and what's at stake for them?
Right. So basically what they're arguing about is how many different species of cinchona tree or bark there are. They actually seem to be, you know, Muti seems to be more talking about the bark and Ruiz and Pavone are talking more about the trees. But how many different kinds of quina are there? And the reason why this is important is I mean, there are a whole host of reasons, but one reason is that, you know, the Spanish crown, which is supposed to have a monopoly on the best bark, they want to know what's the best bark so they can monopolize it. But it's also incredibly important to the local producers in Loja, and then you start to get bark production spread, starts up near Bogota, where Mutis is based. And it's important because if they can establish that their kind of quina is equivalent to the quina that was coming from Loja, or you know, equally as good, whatever, you know, then it has value, right? So part of what is driving this debate is the question about, you know, the literal commercial value of these barks. But then there's also the medical question, right? Are these medically efficacious? Should they be sold in pharmacies and so forth? So the stakes are very high, and then they kind of get rolled into this larger discussion that's happening in the Spanish imperial world in the late 18th century about, you know, sort of royal control of the empire versus maybe a more free trade model. And, you know, the Spanish crown, as part of what's known as the Bourbon Reform, starts to kind of liberalize trade. And I say that quote unquote because it's a very small step towards liberalization, but sort of opening up trade a little bit more. And so there's this, you know, that larger context reverberates through this debate because, as you said, the major players are sort of on either side of this. And I really try to think about, you know, how this debate over the scientific knowledge is connected to these questions about the imperial order and so forth.
Great. So Matt, there's also a conclusion in the book, and we won't have time to talk about it at too much length, but there are a number of really interesting extensions of the story and sort of larger methodological and conceptual points that you're making here. So I want to just ask you about one of them and then invite you If you'd like to open out into any other of the major points you're making in the conclusion that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet, please do so. So I'll start with the question about sort of imperial science in the early modern world. One of the things that comes up at the very beginning of the book, and this is reiterated here in the conclusion, is that if I could sort of kind of summarize it this way, a lot of stories about empire and science or imperial science in the early modern world tend to be stories about a very limited number of empires, right? And one of the things that the book is doing is showing the importance of the Spanish Atlantic to early modern science. And this particular case for, you know, shaping how we understand what's happening here. So would you say a little bit about that? And then, you know, if you'd like, if there are any other major conceptual points that you'd like to leave us with, please feel free to open out into that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I thought about in writing this book and part of what maybe explains my you know, what you reference about the importance of the Spanish Atlantic world. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of scholarship in the last two decades or so. And again, some of the folks I mentioned earlier, like Jorge Canizares Esguerra, Daniela Bleichmar, and, you know, Antonio Barrera, Maria Portuondo. I mean, there are lots of folks, you know, sort of thinking about, you know, there's, and this is a larger sort of part of the story of early modern Spain and the early modern Spanish Atlantic world. You know, the sort of traditional historiography, and this dates back to the early modern period itself with the Black legend and all of that, is, you know, Spain was sort of seen as the kind of anti-hero to modernity, being left out of the Renaissance, the Scientific Revolution, the Enlightenment, and so forth. And so, you know, there's been a lot of scholarship, you know, for many decades now that has really tried to tackle that narrative, you know, and that idea that, that Spain is somehow other and outside of the story of Europe or the rest of the Atlantic world or whatever it may be. And, you know, I sort of thought to myself, you know, I feel like there's, you know, when I was thinking about this book, I had the sense that, you know, there's a good body of scholarship that has really made the case that Spain, or the Iberian world, because there's certainly people writing about the Portuguese world, should be part of the story, you know. And so what I wanted to do with this book was really think about, okay, given that we're now thinking about the Iberian world as part of the story of the narratives of modernity, Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, whatever, what is this Spanish Atlantic case? What can it add to our understanding about the history of science, or the history of science and empire, right? And so I really tried to make it not just a book about, like, oh, yeah, see, there are these things happening in the Spanish Atlantic world too, right? Science is there or whatever. But just take that as a given and then say, all right, now how does this enrich our, you know, our history of science, you know? And so I think, or I hope, the main contribution that I'm trying to make on that score is really explore a case where there seem to be good reasons for science and empire to work together quite well, right? I mean, because if you think about it, this is an empire trying to take control of the production and distribution of a tree bark. I mean, that doesn't really sound that complicated when you put it in those terms, right? You know, but this turns out to be a remarkably complicated problem. As is any form of natural resource management. I mean, just think about debates that are happening now about climate change and endangered species and so forth. And so, you know, one of the big things I talk about is this idea of, like, the fragility of science and, you know, really remembering that the early modern period, people hadn't gone through the 19th century and the 20th century yet. You know, the utility of science wasn't necessarily evident yet. And so trying to start from that position and really think about, you know, what were the challenges that came up in this case and try to tell a story where, you know, there is a really good faith effort and a strong investment on the part of the Spanish crown to really wield science as a tool of empire. But in this case, it doesn't work out. And I think it's interesting to think about why. And it's not just because Spanish science is deficient or, I mean, that's not even a reason that's on the table as far as I'm concerned, right? So given that, you know, what are the other explanations that we can come up with, and how does that, as I said, enrich our understanding of the history of science and empire?
Thank you so much, Matt. And thank you for bringing us, I think, to a really, really nice close and bringing us into our conclusion today. So there's obviously, and this is clear, right, even from the last hour, there's obviously so much that we could have talked about that we didn't talk about in the context of the book. But given that, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners that we didn't have a chance to get to?
No, I feel like we gave the book a pretty fair airing. So,
and now that the book is out for you, what are you working on now? What are you inspired by? What are you writing?
Right. Yeah. So I have sort of two lines of research that I'm following. The one that I've been working on most recently is a project that I'm calling How Drugs Became Modern, with firm awareness of all the problems associated with all the terms in that that title, but it's a sort of broader history to look to try to understand how and why the transition from predominantly botanical medicaments in Western medicine to a predominantly chemical medicaments. So, you know, sort of the pithy way I put it is, you know, in the 18th century, if you went to a pharmacist, they were likely to start with some kind of plant material, raw plant material, and, you know, make something for you to take. Whereas today, I mean, you know, 9 times out of 10 or maybe more than that, you know, you go to your pharmacist and you buy your bottle of nondescript white pills, you know. And so just it's meant to be a kind of bigger history, kind of thinking about that transition. And what I've been doing most recently is just looking through published pharmacopoeias and looking at the different sort of relative amounts of botanical, chemical, and material, animal materia medica in those pharmacopoeias, which is kind of mind-numbing work, but I think it's going to produce some interesting results, or at least I hope. But I'm at the very beginning stages of that line of research. So,
great. Well, thank you, Matt, so much for taking time away from that to talk about this book. Best of luck with that, and it's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us at the podcast today, and come back soon.